Hello, my friends, and welcome to the next episode of the Just One More Thing podcast. Thank you for joining me so much. My name is Norji, and I hope that everything has been going well for all of you out there since the last time I was able to check in. 2024 is plowing ahead. I mean, it's already spring, and officially, and we've had some pretty interesting weather, being that we're in Wisconsin, but we're already starting in April, the first week, and we're halfway through that week. But April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And in order to bring some awareness and some focus into this topic, I wanted to invite some very involved people sort of at the forefront of advocacy and awareness and education of the topic. So joining me today are two representatives of Belief Survivors, which is a local nonprofit organization that deals in sexual assault survivors and providing resources to them, as well as children who are affected by the same thing. So introducing the executive director, Karen Featherston, and then the program director, Samantha Sustacek. Thank you, ladies, for joining me today.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Let's go ahead and get started and have you both introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about what you do here at Belief and how you sort of got involved with the organization.
All right. Well, I guess I'll start. I'm Karen Featherston. I'm the executive director, and I've been doing this work associated with the services and programs that we have here for 24 years now. I started out just doing some part-time work with child abuse prevention, and it went into doing more full-time work in grant writing and administrative, as well as direct service, doing classroom presentations for SCAN, our program about child abuse prevention. And then during the pandemic years, things kind of got shaken up, and I ended up taking on more of a leadership role within Belief Survivors and ended up as executive director, and here I am today.
And I have been with the Sexual Assault Services Program in a variety of different ways for going on 19 years now. So I started out as the volunteer coordinator, and then I moved into the family support advocate position, which supported families at the Child Advocacy Center who were there because their children had experienced some kind of abuse. And then I became the program supervisor. And then when we became Belief Survivors, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit, that's when I became the program director. So Karen and I have both been around for a while.
Mm-hmm. With this organization, but
correct,
much longer involved in the kind of work that you do in this organization. Mm-hmm. Because if my memory serves correctly, the organization sort of morphed from something else, mm-hmm, which provided the same services, and I can't remember what it was called, and I apologize. Mm-hmm. And then you guys were able to declare as a nonprofit, mm-hmm, and then you decided to change the name to reflect
yes,
sort of the mission. So can you tell us about
absolutely
that?
Absolutely. So there are two programs within our organization, Stop Child Abuse and Neglect and Sexual Assault Services. And for many, many years, decades, those were programs and services under the umbrella of Lutheran Social Services.
Mm-hmm.
So SCAN has been around in the Racine community for 46 years now.
Wow.
Yes, and Sexual Assault Services for
25
years. This will be a good anniversary. So those programs were part of LSS for decades. In 2018, Lutheran Social Services had some new leadership changes and restructured and decided that those two programs were just not in the direction that they wanted their services to be aligned.
Sure.
They thought we had great services, but it just didn't fit what their mission was now going to be associated with. So that was right before the pandemic. That was 2018. And so we got a fiscal agent, were able to keep SCAN and SAS services going. And during the pandemic, really took that as an opportunity to say, hey, let's make our own 501c3. Let's
sure,
continue these services in Racine, but instead of being under the leadership of Lutheran Social Services, we'll be our own independent 501c3. So we took that kind of step back during the pandemic to do all the paperwork and get all of those, important certifications done. And then we launched As Belief Survivors, the new 501c3, on July 1st of 2021.
It seems like so long ago, doesn't it?
It does, and it does, and it doesn't. Yeah.
and you know, to think that it's already kind of scary, mm-hmm. because you're stepping into this arena of, you know, now you're separating yourself from your previous leadership and declaring as a 501c3 nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously there's sort of a fear that comes into navigating that. But then also the pandemic comes along, and now you have to navigate the mm-hmm. reality of not only are you trying to create your own footprint now with this new condensed organization, mm-hmm. but now you have to deal with the pandemic and the realities of people social distancing and not mm-hmm. being able to necessarily provide services in the way that mm-hmm. you were before the pandemic. So I guess while we're on the subject of the pandemic, during that time, how did it affect your ability to provide services? And has any of that stuck around or forced you or caused you to think about other ways where you've evolved in how you provide some of these services? For example, in the working world, including here, a lot of things went virtual. So there were a lot of virtual meetings with Zoom and Teams. Mm-hmm. So are there any examples like that where you have kept some of those pandemic era protocols that have maybe been beneficial for the organization?
There definitely have been some things that we've kept because we found that they were beneficial. We, as a team, learned how to work remotely. And while we are usually in the office now, and we actually prefer that, we like to be with each other in the same physical space. Sure. We do have the capability of working remotely now if we need to. But the biggest thing that we've kept from the pandemic is telehealth. So we have some therapists on our staff. And prior to the pandemic, we had never even thought about doing virtual counseling. But then we had to. So we figured out how to do it. And it actually breaks down barriers for some of our clients, that they don't have to actually come into the office. Maybe they don't have a car, or sure. they don't have money for gas. And or honestly, even maybe somebody's a little bit sick and they maybe shouldn't come in and see their counselor in person. That doesn't mean they have to skip their therapy appointment that week. They can pivot to telehealth. And so we've definitely kept that around. Mm-hmm. Can you think of other things we've kept around?
There's been benefits in terms of staff training and education,
sure.
where we wouldn't be able to send staff maybe to a 3-day conference with all the travel expenses, but a lot of those conferences have now pivoted to being either solely virtual or hybrid, so we have the opportunity to allow them to experience that without having the associated costs of,
sure.
of, you know, mileage and
even lunching. In my line of work, I have the flexibility to do work from home, remote stuff. And while I appreciate the opportunity to have that that option, I always find that I'm more productive in the office, and that's where my stuff mm-hmm. is, and that's where my setup is, and I just feel more empowered to do my job. Mm-hmm. Not agreed. That I can't do it from home, but I just, you know, it's different.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And plus, you know, my dog can be distracting, and I want to play with her all the time, and I can't bring her to the office, so. Mm-hmm.
You can bring her to our office.
Sure.
Yeah.
She loves people. She yes. really does. And she would not want to leave this place. So you talked a little bit about this, that mm-hmm. There are two different mm-hmm. programs. You have the SAS, mm-hmm. and then you have the one for children, which
children
is...
Child abuse, yes. So we have the two programs under Belief Survivors. One of them is called SCAN, Stop Child Abuse and Neglect. The other is Sexual Assault Services, or SAS. And I tell people, if you want to think of it, that they're sister programs. We sort of refer to them as sister programs because we've always worked in conjunction with each other and kind of lived together in shared space. So they're the sister programs under the parent of Belief Survivors.
Sure.
You know, the parent that does all the services and the security that allows them to do the work.
So is it fair to say that within both of these programs that there might be some overlap where, because of a particular situation, that there might be cause where one program needs mm-hmm. to refer mm-hmm. someone that is coming to you for services to the other program?
Sure. So, for example, SCAN, Stop Child Abuse and Neglect. They primarily go into classrooms across Racine County and do child abuse prevention programming for kids as young as preschool going through sixth grade. During those lessons, kids are all taught what abuse is, what to do if it happens, how to get help in age-appropriate ways, obviously,
sure.
from a preschool to a sixth grader. But during any of those lessons, a child can and has come forward to the facilitator saying that something is going on at home that isn't appropriate or could be considered abusive. So let's say that happens, and being mandated reporters, they report it to Human Services. Human Services might go out and do an investigation depending on the report, and if they find that there's some justification for there having been abuse, they'll be seen likely at the Child Advocacy Center, mm-hmm. where we'll have one of the SAS staff go out to the Child Advocacy Center while the child is having an exam for evidence collection or being able to have an interview with a forensic interviewer. Then our staff member will sit with the family, give support, give resources, say what we have to offer on the sexual assault services
sure.
part of it if it was a sexual abuse case, and just be able to, I mean, I always tell people, what is it? You know, if you have a child who's just disclosed abuse, that's not something that happens every day. It's not something you study for. It's not something you think about as
right.
a parent. And you get there and you're just shocked. Like, where do I go? What do I do? Who do I talk to? So we're the people that go into that situation and say and lay it out. This is what you can expect. This is where you can get this resource. This is what we can offer you for help. Then maybe that child needs counseling. Well, we can provide therapy for that child, you know, here at Belief Survivors, or, you know, we can provide an advocate for the family to help them through the legal system if they choose to go that route. So they are interrelated.
Sure.
I just think of SCAN as being much more prevention and sexual assault services as being more intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in what you just said, you talked about getting into the schools and mm-hmm. and providing education and information about the services and that kind of thing. So, along those lines, I want to talk about some terms and some things around the topic that are a little more dense or a little more complicated. Mm-hmm. And I think that for the benefit of the listeners out there and for the purposes of education, that it's worth talking about. So without sounding like this is being simple or anything to make light of the situation, can you provide us with what is the definition of sexual assault, sexual violence, and sexual abuse?
Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I have like official definitions of those things. I think different people use them in different ways.
Sure.
I personally kind of think of sexual violence as kind of the overarching umbrella of those things. Usually when we talk about sexual abuse, we're often talking about children. So things that happen to children, whereas sexual assault, more often we're talking about adults. But basically, either one of those things, it's any kind of unwanted, forced or coerced contact with intimate body parts, basically, without consent. So I guess without consent is implied when you're talking about being forced or coerced.
But, sure.
Yeah.
And along those lines, because, you know, obviously consent is a huge thing here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think to be clear that especially when it comes to children, there is no such thing as consent.
That is correct.
Correct.
They're in the sense that also like in like the Department of Corrections, a relationship of a sexual nature between a staff member and a inmate is illegal. There, mm-hmm. even if the inmate or the staff member agree to do it, there's no consent. It's still a law being broken.
Yeah, there's too much of a power differential there.
Right, and so children can consent.
No, correct.
And so, as far as consent is concerned, can you tell us what constitutes consent where it is appropriate? And applies to adults.
Yeah, we like to say that consent is the presence of yes, not the absence of no. So there's kind of a we have a little like shorthand for consent, which is FRIES. I don't know if you've ever heard that before, and I'm going to read it because otherwise I'm going to forget some of these. So it stands for freely given, so no coercion, no convincing somebody to do something. Reversible, so you can say no at any time, even if things have already started. Informed, so basically everybody understands what's going on and what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Enthusiastic, so no manipulation, no one is giving in to something or feeling pressured to do something. And specific, so you can say yes to one thing, but that doesn't mean that you're saying yes to everything. So maybe you're saying yes to kissing, but you're not saying yes to sex. So FRIES. FRIES equals
FRIES.
Yep.
No, and I've never heard that before, mm-hmm. but I think that's great that it gives people a mnemonic to mm-hmm. to
sure.
refer to.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously these terms are difficult to talk about, and the subject is difficult to talk about. But the only way that we can sort of spread awareness and educate people is to talk about these difficult topics. And you know, you mentioned with the with a program where you go into the schools mm-hmm. and talk to kids. And that's something I want to touch upon later. You know, mm-hmm. obviously it has a lot to do with funding and that kind of stuff, and a school's willingness to have this kind of thing happen in their under their watch.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I want to talk about that, you know, again, especially because this has become such a hot button issue, and great because it needs to be talked about more. But for far too long, there have been certain pockets of society that perpetuate a narrative that in instances of sexual assault or abuse or sexual violence, that the victim is somehow to blame for the situation,
mm-hmm.
which has created this awful stigma for victims of sexual assault, making them feel that there's no point in reporting the assault because society has told me that, you know, it's my fault. You know, the legal system has let me down too many times before. I'm afraid that the person who, the aggressor, the attacker, who committed this awful crime against me is going to retaliate against me. And so can you talk about this particular stigma surrounding what is now known as victim blaming culture, and what do you do as an organization, and what can the normal human being out there do to help sort of combat this, the existence of this awful victim blaming culture?
There is a ton of victim blaming, and it's ridiculous because we don't blame the victims of other crimes for being victims of crime. It's something about sexual assault makes us want to blame the victim. And I think in some cases, honestly, people do that because they don't want to think that they themselves could be a victim. So they say, well, I wouldn't wear that, or I wouldn't have gotten that drunk, or I wouldn't be alone walking at night, so this isn't going to happen to me. That's something that, you know, that person did that caused that to happen.
Sure.
So it's and victims definitely internalize that. I mean, we are all swimming in that society, in that culture, and so it is really important to continue to talk about it. And I remind survivors that I work with all the time that it's not their fault. I so frequently I've had to tell people, no, this is not your fault. This is not something you did. This is something that someone chose to do to you. And you did nothing to cause this. So it's important to tell victims or survivors that. And it's also important, you know, if you hear other people talking that way about a sexual assault victim, to say something and to speak up, because it's really important that we combat that culture.
And I think just every part of sexual assault services and Belief's mission as a whole points to that too. So for the sake of your listeners out there, Belief is spelled B-E and then a capital L-E-A-F, and the L-E-A-F stands for lifting, empowering, advocating, and fighting for survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And in all of those types and categories of services that we have, we're trying to fight that stigma. So like our lifting services are our crisis intervention, our hotline that survivors can call 24/7, 365 when they're feeling maybe feelings of self-blame, self-doubt, embarrassment or shame, that there'll be someone on the other end of that phone to let them know this isn't about you, you know, and try to reassure them. Or someone that goes to the hospital, an advocate that will go when someone is there at the emergency room for evidence collection at their darkest moment where they might be questioning, what did I do to bring this on?
Sure.
That we have a person there that is telling them, no, this is not about you. This is about the person who chose to hurt you. So those are our lifting services, our the empowerment services are our therapeutic services that we offer with free counseling for survivors and support groups, therapeutic support groups, peer support groups. All of those things can go to help the survivor break that stigma. Our advocacy services, whether it's legal advocacy, medical advocacy, personal advocacy, family advocacy, that message keeps coming through. And of course, you know, the fighting for survivors, any work we do in the community, if it's a tabling event about what we do or talking about consent or talking about the prevalence of sexual assault, those are ways that we're spreading those ripples throughout the community to break that stigma. So I think it's all in our name.
It's, I know that I don't want to speak for the two of you, but it would be foolish for me to assume that you haven't come across in your personal life or professional life where there are instances where you see people that very callously and childishly make jokes about this kind of thing. I mean, even whenever you see a story on social media about someone going to prison or something like that, there's always that very antiquated joke about, the prison system. And so I think that I would be willing to say that I'd group these two topics together because of the attitude towards the subject material, that it's a joke and that people say certain things or spit out these awful cliches because it's funny or they think it's topical or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's really not. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame because, again, it adds to the difficulty and the stigma surrounding someone who is trying to navigate something terrible that happened to them and figure out how they proceed and how they go on with their life. And like you were saying, like, what did I do to deserve this? And it's bad enough to have to suffer that fate without having to be reminded of it by people who are just saying awful things. So,
yep. It's hard to heal when you're blaming yourself for what happened to you.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And so to further the topic, of victims being afraid to report an assault, I kind of wanted to pose this next question. If someone became aware that someone they know or care about was the victim of a sexual assault, who was afraid to report it, but told them, you know, their friend or loved one, but pleaded with them to not tell anyone, you know, but don't tell anyone. I don't want to, you know, I'm afraid or I don't know what's going to happen. I don't want something to happen to me. What is the advice that you would give the person who the victim or survivor confided in, who doesn't know how to proceed? Because I think that this is something that happens a lot more than we realize.
Yeah. I mean, we have people call our hotline sometimes saying, you know, my friend or my girlfriend or whoever, my loved one, had this experience and, we don't know what to do about it. Truly, if you're talking about adult people always need to be able to make their own decisions. Our goal here is to re-empower survivors. So if someone truly doesn't want to report, we don't want to force them to do that or try to push them towards doing that if it's really not right for them, because we're not living their life and we can't make any promises about what's going to happen. And for some people, that may truly make it worse. Adults can come to us and seek services without making any kind of police report.
Sure.
So,
children are a different story.
Children are a different story, and I'll let you speak to that. But as far as adult people are concerned, we want them to make their own decisions.
Before we get to the the children's side of the equation or the scan side, is it fair to say that for the person who was confided in, that you would encourage them to reach out to you guys or other similar organizations to mm-hmm. seek advice and counsel about mm-hmm. what they should do or resources that could be provided to the survivor?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think a lot of times people don't even know we exist until they need us. Even sometimes when they do need us, they don't know we exist. So, yes, we would always say that they can call. People can call our hotline and remain completely anonymous. If they don't even want to give their name, they don't have to do that. We'll help them to the best of our ability. They can come into the office and participate in any of our services, and we're not going to push them to report. If they do decide that they want to report, we'll be there with them every step of the way. We'll go to the police station with them, or we'll call law enforcement and ask law enforcement to come here and take the report if mm-hmm. that is the direction they decide to go in. So we try to make sure that people know their options. And as for that supportive person who's reaching out on behalf of their loved one, we encourage them to remain supportive. And, you know, just having someone who believes a survivor and will listen to them is a really healing thing. So we want those support people to keep doing what they're doing and keep caring.
And that's great advice. Karen, on mm-hmm. the SCAN side, mm-hmm. Because obviously children, as you guys said, is a completely different story. So mm-hmm. Speak to that portion of this conversation.
Well, for children, if a child discloses, there are multiple types of adults in that child's life who are considered mandated reporters. By law, they need to pass along information if they have a belief that a child is being abused physically, sexually, emotionally,
sure.
or neglected. Those would include people like, you know, teachers and counselors at school. I think basically now any adult person that works within a school is considered a mandated reporter.
Sure.
Doctors, nurses, daycare workers,
therapists,
you know, those are people that cannot keep abuse a secret. Other adults in a child's life, aunts, uncles, neighbors, you know, anybody that isn't considered a mandated reporter, by law, they don't have to do that. I would hope that they would if a child would disclose to them. And if a child discloses to another child, which I get that question a lot when I would work with sixth graders, where they'd say, I have a friend who told me mm-hmm. this. A child is not required to report. So I would say, similar to what Sam was saying, be a good friend to your friend and listen and believe. Try to tell your friend about the options that are out there. Talk to a counselor. Call our support line. Call our offices and, you know, talk anonymously with someone or something. I would give suggestions to, like, the sixth graders that if you were really worried about a person and you don't know what else to do, maybe just slip a note under the counselor's door saying,
sure.
so-and-so is having a hard time. Maybe you want to talk with them. Mm-hmm. And that would give them the opportunity to be in the same room with someone who's caring and would help them.
It's amazing to me as an adult now, thinking back on some of the things that you heard as a kid mm-hmm. and how back then it didn't really land with you. But now as an adult, you hear it and you're like, it explains things just so succinctly that nothing more needs to be said. And the thing that I think of, you know, that I heard during DARE mm-hmm. Class or mm-hmm. Other things as a kid is, if you see something, say something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that applies here. Like, if you suspect that someone you know is suffering or is the victim of something, you know, and you don't know what to do, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, slip a note under the counselor's door, maybe mm-hmm. mention something to your teacher, because mm-hmm. that could be that person's mm-hmm. escape from a very terrible situation mm-hmm. and circumstance. So, if you see something, say something.
Mm-hmm.
Another sort of widely held stigma, and I want to preface this by saying that, you know, I don't mean this to make it seem like it's less important or more important or doesn't hold the same weight as other things. And please don't send me hateful emails or anything. But, you know, I want to have this conversation. So sexual assault, sexual abuse, sexual violence is a crime that disproportionately affects females more than it does males.
Mm-hmm.
But the stigma, I mean, you can't argue with the numbers, mm-hmm. and the numbers are disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
But the stigma exists that this isn't a crime that happens to men, just mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. Men can't be victims. Can you talk about how this stigma affects the amount of males that maybe report mm-hmm. to you and ask for your services, and maybe any statistics that you might have relating to sexual crimes against men?
Well, I could share a little story that kind of illuminates the answer that I'm going to give. So when I would do a sixth grade presentation, one of the resources that I would put up is now kind of ancient history. It was an Oprah Winfrey show called 200 Men, and she had 200 men who had survived childhood sexual abuse in her audience to share stories about what happened to them and to give support to each other. And I put on that show, and one of the sixth grade boys raised his hand and said, "Where did she find 200 men who had been sexually abused as boys?" And I said, "Oh, honey, I am so sorry to tell you this, but one out of every six women is
one out of every six men.
I mean, one of every three women, one out of every six men. Thank you, Sam. One out of every six men has been a victim of some sort of unwanted sexual contact in their lifetime. It's hard to say how accurate those statistics are. I kind of think they might even be underreported mm-hmm. because men don't think it happens to men. And then if it happens to them, they feel like a unicorn and they don't want to be the first one to go through that door and get that kind of help. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to do a better job of educating people that it's not just Me Too, the Me Too movement, it's the Men Too movement, you know, that it happens to men mm-hmm. too. There are a lot of misconceptions about it, and that's just one of the misconceptions, is that it doesn't happen to men.
Sure.
But it does. Some other misconceptions that we have resources that we tell people about are that a sexual act that's forced upon a boy is really just a rite of passage, you know, that
It's that whole hot teenage boy thing.
That really they're going to end up enjoying it. Yeah. So why are we making a big deal
about it? Just consider yourself
it?
Lucky, man. Yeah. That, you know, that's mm-hmm. all the boys should yes. go through that.
Yes. Or that male victims who seek support are just weak. You know, that they should be able to deal with the trauma on their own and just get past it. Or that men who have been victims of sexual violence will become perpetrators themselves. And so they think, well, if I go forward to get help, people are going to be looking at me all the time like, when are you going to turn around and do something to someone?
Sure.
You know, that's a misconception as well. Some other ones would be that if a man has some sort of physiological response during a sexual assault, that means that was consensual.
That actually goes for women,
too. That goes for women, too, yes. Mm-hmm. So men feel like maybe they were a part of it and that they were – you know, in
a willing participant
mm-hmm. or giving consent. And then also that experiencing sexual violence as a boy or even as an adult will mean that you'll become gay or that you are gay, that you're giving off gay vibes, things like that. Obviously, misconception. That is definitely not the case. And it is certainly not the case that gay men are the only ones that are sexually abusing other men.
Sure.
That is a definite misconception that I want to break. So I think there's that whole stigma that surrounds all of those that gets
Absolutely.
Men to feel like I am not going to be the one to report because people are going to believe all of those things about me, you know.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to speak for all men, but mm-hmm. as a guy myself, I definitely remember growing up and even now where, you know, if there's something that happens to you in life that, you know, is against the grain or maybe something you weren't prepared to happen to you, that, no, just, you know, walk it off or do some push-ups mm-hmm. or, you know, mm-hmm. be a man up and
yeah, put it behind you.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important that men should feel empowered mm-hmm. to report or seek resources or services for being a survivor. And it's the same thing that has happened with mental health issues and suicide mm-hmm. prevention, that that's something where there's a disproportionate number because the suicide rate tends to be higher for men than it does for women. And I think a lot of that lends itself to because men have been conditioned to not seek services or help or counseling mm-hmm. because it's looked at mm-hmm. as weak or mm-hmm. Beneath you. So for any men listening out there who might be a survivor and you're looking for an outlet or some resources, you know, we mm-hmm. empower you to do so. Reach out to Belief, reach out to similar organizations, mm-hmm. and get the help that you need, and you know, talk to a family member, whatever the case may be. But you're not alone out there, and you should certainly feel empowered to get that off of your chest and share your story.
Absolutely.
Yep, we're here for everybody.
You mentioned before the Me Too movement, and mm-hmm. that actually is my next topic of conversation, because the Me Too movement actually started back in 2006 in a MySpace post, and then has continued. But then in 2017, it sort of caught fire and became viral. And this campaign took the world by storm by empowering survivors of sexual assault to come forward and share their experiences, not only to help shine a light on the extent of their plight and their story and experience, but also to cast a light on just how large the number is of people who have been victims of assault and are survivors. And also to help demonstrate to other survivors that they are not alone in this struggle and in this journey. So what sort of impact has the Me Too movement had on Belief concerning the number of people maybe who have decided to seek out your services? And how has it impacted your advocacy strategy and the way that you spread awareness and education?
You know, this isn't probably going to be a very interesting answer for you, because I don't know that I saw a major impact, of the Me Too movement on the number of people we were seeing. Now, numbers of people that we have seen since I started almost 19 years ago doing this work, have steadily grown, but I think that has had more to do with, our capacity and the number of staff. You know, when I started, I think we had maybe 3 staff, and now we have 8 staff. Mm-hmm. So it's just that, you know, we've have more services available now, so we're seeing more people. I think you're absolutely right that Me Too allowed a lot more people to feel like they could come forward and mm-hmm. say that this had happened to them. So I'm sure that we have certainly seen some people who we wouldn't have seen if it weren't for that. You know, nobody wants to feel like they're alone in something and that they're the mm-hmm. only one that something has happened to.
Sure.
So there are a lot of bad things about social media, but there are some good things about social media too. And I think this is one of them. And because social media is just such a part of everybody's everyday life now, and this kind of happened during the pandemic too. We really have a lot more of a social media presence. Belief has a Facebook page and an Instagram and a whatever we're calling Twitter these days.
The artist formerly known as Twitter.
Exactly. So we try to reach people that way as well. So, you know, when you're talking about the Me Too movement, it came out of social media. And so we try to meet people where they're at. And if that means getting on social media, that's what we're going to do.
And maybe that's the real answer there, is not necessarily that it hasn't increased mm-hmm. the number of people who have reached out about your services, but it has maybe had an effect on the way that your outreach works with social media mm-hmm. and using all these different digital platforms to reach a much wider audience out there, because you're right, social media is so polarizing mm-hmm. because of how it's evolved and how it's affected our ability to communicate, and how, you know, especially politics and things mm-hmm. like that. But on the flip side of that coin, it allows us to communicate with a much wider group or number of people to spread a message much more simply that, you know, 20, 30 years ago would have to be in mm-hmm. a newspaper or in a yep. magazine or mm-hmm. in a mailer or something like that. So that's probably the silver lining mm-hmm. For you guys for the Me Too movement. But no, and I don't think that, you know, your answer isn't as exciting, but, you know, obviously mm-hmm. it's interesting to hear that perspective, because you never want to assume that just because the Me Too movement happened, like, oh, all of a sudden things mm-hmm. are sunshine and roses. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's just one movement, one pebble that started rolling down mm-hmm. a hill and started mm-hmm. an avalanche. But I I appreciate the fact that the movement looks to empower people to step forward, to share their experience, but also to let other people know that they're not alone. And I think that's important, is that, like you said, people don't want to feel like they're alone in anything, but especially this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously education and spreading the message and awareness is an important thing. And you touched upon this earlier with the child side of, mm-hmm. of the services. Mm-hmm. And obviously, is there something, whether it's sexual assault services or SCAN, mm-hmm. is there active communication with schools and stuff like that to get into the schools and have training and education and give out literature? And are you finding that there's resistance from people about being able to do something like this? And beyond schools, are there other arenas that you are exploring in terms of, you know, whether it's going to an event and setting up a table and passing out information? What kind of things do you guys do to help spread the message and educate?
Well, I can speak to the school part of it. We haven't had any trouble in Racine getting into schools. We are partnered with Racine Unified, so SCAN lessons are in all the Racine Unified schools. We're in private schools. We're in parochial schools. We're in schools east and west of I-94. So we enjoy an audience for SCAN of about 7,500 kids a year that get lessons. We have had some resistance in other surrounding districts. We've had some funding for surrounding school districts where the sensitive nature of the topics that SCAN talks about have gotten on the radar of some parents who have been less enthusiastic to have that presented in the classroom and feel like that's a topic better addressed within the home environment, which I would disagree with, because the abuse is probably going on in the home environment, so you'd want it to be addressed in a place that is safe and where learning is part of the game, you know, and people are there to listen. And if something happens and a report is made, there are mandated reporters there to help out. So with that being said, it is a struggle in some districts because of that. So one of the strategies that we're looking at employing is having all of the SCAN lessons videotaped. We've applied for some funding to be able to have them professionally documented and then have a link to that online, so that if a school is not having SCAN come in for lessons, that we can reach out to parents in other ways to see those lessons and share them with their kids, or that we can show the parents who might be concerned about the content what the lesson is all about. Sure. So that it can ease their fears that it's totally appropriate. We're not teaching kids about, you know, awful, icky things, and that they can feel better about their kids participating as a protective measure.
And I think, to be clear, and I'm speaking for myself, this is not a partisan issue.
Shouldn't be.
And I fear that with this topic and maybe some other ones, that the resistance might be politically or ideologically motivated. And that's a shame, because, mm-hmm. again, this isn't a topic that should divide people politically or ideologically. This is something that is really, really important, because it affects so many people, mm-hmm. Not the least of which, unfortunately, is children.
Mm-hmm. Of every socioeconomic demographic.
Right. It doesn't say, oh, well, this community is not marginalized enough, so we're going to go to the next community. Yeah. It happens everywhere.
No.
So that's a shame. Mm-hmm. But also not entirely surprising that there is resistance in certain other districts.
Mm-hmm.
So what about on the adult side? Is there anything colleges or places of business or something like that where you guys are going and passing out information and trying to get awareness out there?
Yeah, we do the best that we can because of staffing issues and positions that we maybe once had that we don't have anymore. Our outreach is a little bit more piecemeal. It's not necessarily an official part of anyone's job duties, so we all try to pitch in and do that. We definitely will go to tabling events if we're invited with community partners. Yes, we've definitely gone into colleges. We've worked with Parkside. We've worked with Carthage have tables so that students know about our services, also to recruit volunteers.
Have you done Gateway?
Yes.
A while ago, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while. Yes. So when someone invites us, we make every effort to get there, whether they're inviting us to do a tabling event or if they want an educational presentation of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Herzing mm-hmm. University. So.
Yeah. We provide presentations for foster parents as well about various mm-hmm. topics. Yeah. So we do definitely try to educate adults as well. It's just not as formalized as the SCAN program is.
There's a lot to be said about this topic and how it affects so many people, but I think I would be remiss if I didn't sort of turn this around and say, not only does it affect the people who are on the receiving end of this sort of abhorrent situation, but it has an effect on you, the people here in the trenches that are out there advocating and dealing with these difficult situations day in and day out and hearing these harrowing stories and you know, trying to help mend people who are clearly suffering a very, very profound thing. Do you guys have protocols in place or any kind of employee assistance program for yourselves so that you can deal with the secondhand trauma that comes mm-hmm. with being in this line of work? And can you talk about what is in place and also maybe how this line of work has had an effect on you when you leave for the day?
Yeah. We don't necessarily have any formal arrangements, but we are a very supportive team. We are also a very experienced team. Many of our employees have been here for 10 years or more, so we must be doing something right.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
We're very supportive of each other. If somebody needs help, if somebody has a question, they're not left to their own devices. We will get together. We will help them figure out a solution. If they're having a really hard time with a client or with something that happened and it's really bothering them, we're going to talk about it. We're not going to just ignore it and tell them to suck it up and move on.
Sure.
We also try to have fun as a staff. So we do staff retreats occasionally where we can just, be together without necessarily talking about work, although we always end up talking about work. Uh-huh. But I think it's mostly that we're just a very supportive team. We also offer a very flexible work environment, and we understand that people need time off and time away from this work. So sure. We allow for that. We encourage people to take their PTO, to take their vacation, to step away. Mm-hmm. We cover for each other. We do the best that we can so that people don't burn out. And mm-hmm. it seems to be working for the most part. As for myself, like I said, I've been doing this work for almost 19 years. And every once in a while, something really gets to me. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I, for better or for worse, I'm able to compartmentalize mm-hmm. what I do, even though I literally have to take my work home with me sometimes. We all are on call for our 24-hour hotline. Usually at least once a month. So I literally take that cell phone home with me.
Sure.
I've been able to compartmentalize really well and not burn out. We all have our moments, but for the most part.
So it's fair to say that there's a good work-life balance
we
here.
We try really hard for that.
And
we're
that trying. There's a good support system in place that this team has a very good rapport and support system of each other mm-hmm. and making sure that they are you guys have each other's backs.
It's necessary.
Yes, it is essential.
And it helps to have therapists on staff.
Sure.
As a resource. And I know we have a few life coaches on our board that if things get tough, we can always have employees have that as an mm-hmm. option to go to the life coaches and have a few sessions to see about coping.
And I don't want to get too mm-hmm. personal with your lives here. So mm-hmm. you certainly don't have to respond to this, but me personally, I just and I've been in difficult lines of work that deal with situations like sexual abuse, domestic violence, drugs and substance abuse and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you made a good point. Sometimes you bring your work home with you because you have to, but also it's really hard as a human being to just shut that off when you've seen or witnessed something that is just completely beyond the pale of things that you experience every day. And I would imagine that if you are a parent in this line of work, that it gives you pause and maybe has an effect on how you raise your children and the things that they experience and what you expose them to, because this brings to light a very, very scary thing, which is that there are things in this world that are really, really bad, and this is one of them, and you don't want it to happen to anybody, less your children or someone that you love or care about. So me personally, I feel like this is something that would keep me up at night, especially if I were a parent, because there's just you don't, not because you're saying that your kids are more important than other people, but obviously as a parent you're protective of your tribe, and I would just be scared to death that my children might be victims of this, and I don't know how that would have an effect on me, but just thinking about it makes me very, very terrified.
Well, I'll tell you this, though. When you do the work, and I've done this since my boys have been, well, my boys are now almost 30, let me say that. But I started this job right when they were going into kindergarten.
Sure.
And so I had the advantage of knowing the background of this job all throughout their childhood and talking about it with them all throughout their childhood.
Yep.
So they learned about what is potentially out there, that it's okay to come and talk to me about anything at any time, and they know I would believe them, I would help them through it. So I felt better about it, actually, because I felt empowered enough to talk to them and be able to protect them in that way. Sure, I can't control everything else that's going on.
Right.
They have coaches and they have babysitters and they had sleepovers and, all that kind of stuff that might give people red flags. But because I knew I was instilling them with the knowledge that they needed to be as protected as possible in all those situations, I felt better about it.
That's fair.
That's exactly what I was going to say, too, because, I mean, my children are not almost 30, but
yes.
I currently have school-age children who have gone through SCAN lessons because they're both in Racine Unified. And I also, and my husband, talk to them about these kinds of things as well. So I agree with Karen that I honestly feel really good about what my kids know, and I feel confident that they would tell me if there was something going on.
And that makes me feel a lot better, because, and that's kind of why I brought this up before with the, secondary trauma, secondhand trauma, and making sure that you're taking care of yourselves and each other. I always worry about the people who are in the trenches and that are out there doing the work, because again, they see this over and over and over and over every day. Even on days that they're not working, they see it. And, again, this is not something that is, this isn't a tax accounting or, this isn't, stocking the shelves at a grocery store, and that's not to say that those are bad jobs or anything, but I'm trying to
traumatic.
Right, I'm trying to draw a parallel here. That the things that you're exposed to in this line of work are very, very heavy and very, very weighted, and it's important that obviously you advocate for the people who can't advocate for themselves or are unable to advocate for themselves, but also I want to bring to the light that hopefully in this conversation now I found out that you guys are advocating for each other, because that's an important part of this entire thing, because if you're not right for yourself, it's going to be hard for you to be right for someone else, especially in this line of work. So I'm very happy to hear that you guys have a good work-life balance and that you promote a work-life balance and taking care of each other and promoting ideas like, you know, using your PTO and you know, not getting burned out, but also that your families and your children are very educated in the topic and that you are empowering them to be open and honest with you about all of these things. So obviously, as a nonprofit organization, you have to rely on grants and government funding and the generosity of normal human beings. I have partnered with and talked to on podcast and personally another organization in Kenosha called Women and Children's Horizons. And one of the things that they had brought up in my in a previous conversation is that their funding is going to be cut by, I believe, 70% in October of this year. So I guess my question to you is, do you fall under the same umbrella as they do where your funding is being cut by that much? And if so, is there a plan in place or is there something that is happening to petition lawmakers and legislature to discuss the importance of organizations like this and why the funding should continue?
Well, yes, the VOCA funding, which is the Victim of Crime Act grant.
That's our federal, one of our federal funders.
That pool of money that's coming to the state is getting reduced by 70%. And it once it comes to the state, it gets allocated to about 130 different victim service organizations
currently
across the state of Wisconsin, and Women and Children's Horizons is one of them, and Belief Survivors is also one of those victim service organizations. Every one of those organizations is going to rely on VOCA to a different degree.
To some extent, yeah.
And so for us, yes, it is looking like it could mean a cut in our VOCA funding, will mean a cut in our VOCA funding.
Absolutely.
It remains to be seen how much
of a cut
until we get to
Depends how well we write that grant application.
This month. But at minimum, it will be about a $60,000 cut to our budget, which is
About a person.
That's huge.
That's one less person.
It is huge.
So, yes, there have been in answer to your question, there have been a lot of legislative advocacy tasks that have gone on in the last year at the state level to tell the state of Wisconsin, this is the situation that's going on in every county around the state, that federal fund is being diminished, and can the state somehow step in to mitigate that for all these agencies? Now, phenomenally, we had some success, which is like unheard of
amazing
at the legislature as divided as Wisconsin. But there was a bill that since October, there was a bill that was written that passed through committees, that passed through both the Senate and the Assembly votes and went last week to Governor Evers and he signed it. And it's like, yay, we have some relief. It's 1 year of relief. We had asked for three because it looks like this predicament might last about 3 years.
Sure.
It's 1 year of relief and not as much relief as we had asked for, but it is some relief, yet to be seen how much that will impact our bottom
organization.
Line.
Sure.
But there is also an effort right now currently at the federal level to stabilize this fund. And so we're being asked by our parent organization, WCASA, the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, to do some federal advocacy this spring with Tammy Baldwin's office and Ron Johnson's office to see if we can make similar headway at the on the federal level. And so if people want to help with that, there's a limit to how much we can lobby as an organization, as a nonprofit, and we can never lobby with federal funds. But if people want to help with that effort, I would suggest they follow our social media because we often post during those advocacy sessions about who they should contact, how they should word it, what we would want them to ask for if they care about our services as much as we do.
I have so many feelings on this subject and and even based on what you said. And don't get me wrong, I'm glad that there's at least some relief where Governor Evers signed that bill. But again, I have to say, this is not a partisan issue.
No. Well, and it passed unanimously.
It passed unanimously on both the Assembly and the Senate side, which is like
unheard of in this state.
In this state.
It's because we were very, very passionate as victim services organizations came
together
And we had multiple days at the Capitol, knocking on doors, doing hearings, being present for votes.
Giving testimony. Gathering testimony from survivors.
It also makes me legitimately angry that there's a limit to how much you can lobby. Because it's not like you're lobbying to line your own pockets or to serve your own ends. I wouldn't even call it lobbying. Mm-hmm. I would call it advocating. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can advocate as much as you want. When you get to the point where you're asking people to vote a certain way,
sure.
Then it becomes lobbying. But if we can educate legislators all we want about what our predicaments are.
It's just funny to me how the term lobbying or lobbyist is fungible. Mm-hmm. Depending on who's doing the lobbying. Mm-hmm. And again, this isn't something where you guys are doing this because you're getting some kickbacks or something. You are fighting and advocating for people who really, really need the resources that you provide. Mm-hmm. And in my conversation with Jennifer Payne, who mm-hmm. is the executive director at Women and Children's Horizons, it's very sobering to know that having this funding cut could mean that services are cut, that people won't have work, that there are less people that are able to provide the services. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, it has a huge ripple effect.
Yeah. And some places will have doors closed
absolutely.
Altogether because of those 130-ish that typically get VOCA funding, now they're saying only about 52 will get VOCA funding. And if your organization relies primarily on that, it's going to be hard to keep those doors open.
After the conversation I had with Jennifer Payne originally about where she brought up that the funding was being cut, I mentioned to her, what can we do? Like, is there a way that we can maybe invite a member of the legislature to have a conversation on podcast to see mm-hmm. if there's something that can be done? And I will admit that I have reached out to some members of the legislature mm-hmm. to invite them to have this conversation face to face with people like Women and Children's mm-hmm. Horizons. If that's something that's arranged, would you be interested in being part of that conversation?
Oh, sure.
I think putting someone who has the power of the pen in front of the people who are advocating for those who can't advocate for themselves is a much more powerful thing than just saying, hey, we need help, mm-hmm. or hey, they need help. They need to hear the stories. They need mm-hmm. to see the faces. They need to see, mm-hmm. The work that's being done, and they need to be witness to what great work these organizations do and how the cutting of funding is going to have a detrimental effect, not only on the organizations, mm-hmm. but the people that they serve.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and survivors aren't going to go away.
Right. This problem...
it's not going to go away just because the service gets cut.
This problem doesn't stop because, they cut the funding, so, the problem stops. No, this problem continues.
It gets worse.
And it gets worse because now the advocacy is over, the services are being cut, and then victims don't have access to the resources that they so desperately need. And mm-hmm. and that is, if we ever get to that point, I lose a lot of faith in humanity because, mm-hmm. again, to say this to the point of ad nauseum, this is not a partisan issue.
Mm-hmm. And hurt people. Mm-hmm. I would say people who have been hurt and don't heal are much more likely to hurt themselves in some way or hurt other people down the road.
Sure.
So you're only pushing off a problem onto another generation.
Let's speak in the positive.
yes, let's.
Along the lines of, obviously, government funding mm-hmm. and grants, you rely on the generosity of others. And so I know that Belief does a lot of really cool events and fundraisers. Do you have anything that is coming up that you can tell the listeners about? And perhaps if they're unable to attend, whether they live far away or they're just not able to make it, but still maybe want to be involved or donate, how do they go about that?
We do have an event coming up.
And you say we do a lot of fundraisers, but we don't do a lot of fundraisers. The event that we have coming up is actually our big one.
I said a lot of cool fundraisers.
We do. Okay.
Little... Well, that's, yes.
Karen, well, this one is a wine tasting, so, you know, we'll see if that's cool enough for people. So we do have a wine tasting event called Healing Lights Giving Hope that will be on May 3rd here in Racine at Roma.
And this is
Roma.
Part of the SCAN program, right?
Well, this one is specifically for SAS. Children? Yes. No. Children have an ice cream fundraiser.
Yes, no children at the wine tasting.
No children at the
Thank
wine
you.
Tasting. So, yes, we are having a wine tasting, and if people are interested in getting tickets, they are available through a link on our website, which is beliefsurvivors.org. Also, if they want to participate in the silent auction but can't make the event, that's fine. The silent auction will be online a week prior to the event and end on May 3rd. You don't need to be present to win, so you can bid as much and as often as you would like.
Mm-hmm. And again, watch our social media.
Watch social media, and the website will have a link to that auction as well. If people aren't interested in either the wine tasting or the auction, we do have a donate button on our website that people can just make donations or use the address on the website to mail donations in.
Do people have the option to set it up to where they're donating on like a monthly basis?
Absolutely. They can set up a recurring donation, which is always wonderful for sustainability of the program. We look for that. So in terms of time, talent, and treasure, we are open to people giving to our organization monetarily, in-kind donations, through their time being a volunteer advocate or through board involvement or sitting on a committee of the board without being on the board, or talent-wise, if they have a special talent that they think could make our agency a better place,
sure,
I'd be willing to talk to them.
One of the things on your website, and I want to go into this because I don't know all the details, but you guys have a, what is it called, a pick the date?
We do.
Fundraiser, and instead of me sort of fumbling through what I think that means, you can tell the listeners exactly what it
yes.
means.
Well, this was kind of a brainchild of mine when I did the math. So I found out we're facing roughly a $60,000 VOCA cut at best.
Sure.
And I was looking for a way to promote that recurring giving on a monthly basis, and I added up that if somebody signed up or picked a date out of the year and then committed to giving that number of dollars per month, every month of the year, and we filled in every date on the calendar, which is ambitious, I will agree, that would be more than $70,000 coming in annually to our organization. So, for example, September 19th, my birthday. So if I picked September 19 and gave $19 a month for the year.
Uh-huh. 12 donations of $19.
12 donations of $19. If we could get everybody to fill in a date, our problems for VOCA could be solved. It would be very simple. So it's open, again, a link on the website to show which dates remain open. So far we've got about 6,000, 7,000 covered of that. So we're looking for more dates to get filled. It can be a donation as little as $12 to as much as like, what, 376 or something like mm-hmm. that, you know, for a 31st, if someone would pick a 31st date. So I would think that that's something at everybody's level that they could be able to afford to fit into their charitable giving.
I think that's a fantastic mm-hmm. idea and a really mm-hmm. cool way to sort of personalize mm-hmm. An opportunity to give back to a great organization. So
you can give it to someone as a gift on their birthday.
Yes. Sure.
Or it could be any other day that's special to you, an anniversary, yeah. you know.
I will say this out loud, but when I post this episode on my platform and share it, I will put all of this information in the post so that people can click on links and mm-hmm. get the information that they need or call whatever numbers. But all the information will be out there. But yes, do follow Belief Survivors on social media, especially Facebook, because as someone who does follow them on social media, you guys are very active on social media, but especially Facebook.
Yep.
So you don't let a opportunity go by without letting people know exactly what it is that you're doing and things that are up and coming. And you guys really do a great job of getting the message out there. So if you're out there looking to see what it is that they do or updates on what they're doing, follow them on social media, go to their website, or stop in and meet the crew here. I know it's important for organizations like this to network with other agencies or community partners. What are some of the organizations or agencies that you partner with in order to help accomplish your mission, and how does that affect your outreach and perhaps maybe even your capacity to raise funds or awareness?
I know that I'm probably going to forget some. We work with a lot of community partners. So obviously, and Karen could speak to this as well, but SCAN wouldn't be able to exist without our partnership with RUSD as well as the private and parochial schools in Racine. And SAS works within RUSD as well. We work with the Women's Resource Center here in Racine because a lot of communities like Kenosha, Women's and Children's Horizons is what's known as a dual agency. So they provide services for domestic violence and sexual assault survivors because those two things are often linked together. But here in Racine, we actually have two different agencies that provide those services. So SAS is exclusively a sexual assault service provider. But obviously, because of the overlap and because of the slightly differing services that we offer, we work with the Women's Resource Center, who serves domestic violence survivors. We have a lot of colleges in our community, so we work with those. We have MOUs with we have a lot of correctional institutions in Racine County, too.
Sure.
And we have MOUs with those correctional institutions to go in and provide services for PREA cases, which stands for Prison Rape Elimination Act. So we provide services to survivors who are incarcerated. We have a partnership. We've mentioned a couple times the Racine County Child Advocacy Center.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So we have a staff member who actually has office space there at the CAC. We're a very, very closely linked partners. We've been with the CAC. We actually were a part of starting the CAC in 2008. We also have a number of hospitals in Racine County that have sexual assault nurse examiner programs. So we provide advocates at those hospitals and have linkages with those hospitals. So that would be Ascension, Ascension All Saints, and then Aurora Mount Pleasant, as well as Aurora Memorial Hospital of Burlington. Other partners. Planned Parenthood. We've mm-hmm. worked with Planned Parenthood.
The LGBT Center.
The LGBT Center. Thank you, Karen. Mm-hmm. A lot. I mean, we couldn't accomplish our work without community partners, and
sure.
I think they would say the same about us. We need each other. We in order to provide the full continuum of things that survivors need. We need to have those connections and make use of those connections so that we're making sure that we are best serving the people who come through our door looking for help.
And I think it's important to note that if you did forget anyone, it's not because you don't care or you don't know, but I would imagine that on top of the number of organizations and agencies that you mentioned, there's probably a lot of them that you weren't able to mention just because there are so many.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all sort of a spoke on the wheel of this giant mechanism that is the organization. And I also want to point out, and I think this should be said, and I apologize for not mentioning this at the outset, but all of the services that you offer are available free of charge.
Yep, completely.
And I think that that's another thing to bring to light, that funding this program is super important because these services cost money, but you guys aren't passing that on to the end user. It's through the generosity of people and through funding. But if that funding gets cut, mm-hmm. then obviously that can have an effect on the services that you are able to offer at no charge. So
yes, no survivor should have to pay one dime to heal from something that happened to them.
Absolutely. And so that's just one of the very many reasons that this is a great organization. So, I I applaud the fact that there are so many different organizations and agencies out there that partner with you to help accomplish your mission and spread awareness and educate people and provide resources to the people that need them the most.
Oh, in addition to saying that they're free, they're also bilingual.
Oh.
We offer bilingual services, bilingual therapy, bilingual advocacy, bilingual
yes,
support.
We are fortunate enough mm-hmm. to have two Spanish-speaking mm-hmm. staff members.
That's really cool. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic because Racine County has a very high Spanish-speaking population, so
yes.
it's great that you have
yes,
that that for them to be able to access.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's a lot of great opportunities, and you mentioned this before, that people could donate their time mm-hmm. If they're not able to donate funds or in addition to donating mm-hmm. funds if they're so able to. So what do people or what qualifications are needed for someone who wants to be involved as a volunteer or as a board member, and what steps do they need to take in order to jump in and get involved?
So we couldn't do what we do without our team of volunteer advocates. We have approximately 30 trained volunteer advocates who help us answer our 24-hour hotline and respond to the hospital to support survivors there. So the only requirements to be a volunteer advocate are that you are 18 years old, mm-hmm. that you have access to transportation so that you can get to the hospital if you need to,
mm-hmm.
And that you want to do it and are a compassionate, non-judgmental person. We have, it's approximately an 18-hour training to become a volunteer advocate.
Okay.
So we want to make sure that people are well prepared and that they don't feel like they're just being thrown in without fully knowing what they're doing. That wouldn't
sure.
be good for them or for survivors. So, we have this great team and we are always looking for more volunteer advocates. We try to do about 2 to 3 trainings per year for volunteer advocates. So we just did one in February and we may do another one in late spring or early summer. Just depends on interest. So we kind of wait until we have a good group together because it's a better experience for volunteers to get trained in a group.
So you say the season spring and then I get confused because even though it is spring, it's still wintry outside.
Yeah. Well, you know, it snowed for half the day today.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Go home. Go home, Mother Nature. You're drunk.
Yes, exactly.
But again, I will share on the post for this episode all of the information, the links that you can click mm-hmm. on in order to get access to this stuff. But you can access everything that we've talked about and more by visiting beliefsurvivors.org. That's BELEAF survivors.org. You can contact them. They have their 24-hour helpline, which is 262-637-7233. And again, as Samantha said and as Karen has said, that there is someone on standby 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to answer the phone, to be there to provide services and advocate for people who are in a situation where they need the assistance. Lastly, before we wrap this all up, I'd like to have the two of you talk to directly to anyone out there who is listening right now who might be a survivor, or maybe they are a survivor who's afraid of seeking help or maybe talking to someone or reporting what happened to them because of the stigma or fear of retaliation. Talk directly to that person or those people, and what would you say directly to that person right now to give them some hope?
We stare at each other. Who's going first? I just have to say that I hope that any survivors out there, after listening to us talk, understand that you can always come to us. We will not judge you. We will believe you. We will support you. And you don't have to do this alone. We'll be there with you. We have a wonderful team who wants to help walk you through this process because it's hard to do by yourself, and we want to be there with you. We want to be that support for you.
Yes, and I would echo the same thing and add that even though you might feel like you're broken beyond repair, it can get better. It's going to take some time. It's going to take some guidance. It's going to take some work. But just because something was traumatic in the past doesn't mean that you can't have it get better and feel whole in the future.
I can't thank the two of you enough for giving your time. This small nuance of conversation can have an enormous effect on the people listening out there, whether it's someone who is a survivor or someone who maybe had questions about this topic and maybe weren't sure, and now they have access to this information and access to resources and the information that's out there. And this is just one microcosm of a conversation in a universe where this is something that requires more conversations, difficult conversations, advocacy, sacrifice, volunteering, funding, grassroots, all that kind of stuff. There's so much that's involved here. And if this conversation has a positive effect on even one person, then I think that this is a wonderful thing. But I can't thank the two of you enough for the work that you do here with Belief Survivors, and also the effect that you have on your local community and people who are in situations that are scary, that are traumatic, that are painful to navigate, and that they can know that at the very least, there's one organization here amongst many that will advocate for you, that will provide the services that you need, that will believe you, that will listen to you, that will advocate for your well-being and for your journey through a very profound and difficult thing that you have experienced in your life. So you can reach Belief Survivors online, beliefsurvivors.org. You can call them. Their 24-hour hotline is 262-637-7233. And certainly, if you or someone you know has been affected by sexual violence, it's not your fault. You are not alone. There are lots of people out there, like the people at Belief Survivors, who are here for you, to advocate for you, and certainly your loved ones, your friends, the people that care about you, also want to help you navigate this difficult journey and help you succeed. There is a national hotline for sexual assault. That number is 1-800-656-HOPE. Obviously that's a national number, but I just want to make sure that there's plenty of information out there for everyone who might have it, a need for it. So my thanks to you, Karen and Samantha, for giving your time. And again, this is a conversation that needs to happen often, and you have a open-ended invitation to come on to the podcast anytime to discuss whatever it is that you might want to discuss, to help get the message out there and also to spread awareness and advocate for those who need it the most. So thank you both so much for joining me today. Anything else that you want to tell the folks out there before we wrap it up here?
No, thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Sexual violence thrives on silence. So the more we talk about it, the more we can hopefully prevent it.
That's a fantastic way to wrap things up. Ladies, thanks so much for your time. Again, the information will be out there. Belief Survivors, check them out, beliefsurvivors.org. Give them a call. Follow them on social media. Volunteer, donate, lobby your local congressman or your legislature and let them know this funding is important, that this is something that needs to continue to happen. So you can make a difference. And again, for the survivors out there, you are not alone. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.